The next discussion with Trump on Ukraine that I recall was not until June 25th. I was in Israel to meet Netanyahu and for a trilateral meeting with Patrushev and Ben Shabbat, but I attended an NSC meeting via video conferencing from our former Jerusalem consulate near the David Citadel Hotel, where I was staying. The meeting, held in Washington in the sit room with the usual crew attending, was to discuss other matters, but at one point, Trump riffed on Nord Stream 2, complaining about our great European allies and Germany's low spending on defense. Angela Merkel saying she'd be there, 2% of GDP, by 2030. Remember that, John, he said to the screen in the sit room where I was visible from Israel. I listen to my advisors despite what people think. Trump laughed, so did I, and then he was off again in full roar. Everyone screws us on trade. This is going to be the best June in years. The tariffs have a lot of money pouring in. Then it was off to Ukraine and a $250 million assistance program for weapons purchases. Did you approve it, John? I said it was a congressional earmark that the Defense Department was proceeding with. How stupid is this? Trump asked. Germany doesn't spend on neighboring countries. Angela says, we don't spend because it's a neighboring country. John, do you agree on Ukraine? I didn't answer directly, worrying about what had suddenly made Trump pay attention to this particular military assistance. Instead, I suggested that Esper raise all these questions about NATO and Ukraine burden sharing at the NATO defense ministers' meeting scheduled in the coming days. This was likely the first time I heard security assistance to Ukraine called into question. But the real issue was how Trump found out about it, and who came up with the idea to use it as leverage against Zelensky and his new government. I never learned the answers to these questions, but Mulvaney, in his continuing capacity as the director of the Office of Management and Budget, was certainly one possible source. The key point that I carried away from this conversation was that the Ukraine security assistance was at risk of being swallowed by the Ukraine fantasy conspiracy theories. On July 10th, I met in my office with my Ukrainian counterpart Oleksandr Danilyuk, the new secretary of their National Security and Defense Council. Danilyuk was a pro-Western reformer. Formerly Poroshenko's finance minister, he had resigned because he didn't believe Poroshenko's government was committed to real reform. Perry, Sondland and Volker all asked to attend. Did Sondland spend any time in Brussels? And it was clear immediately that the three of them were trying to squeeze me into inviting Zelensky to the White House before the July parliamentary elections. Since I knew, and they should have realized after their May 23rd Oval Office meeting with Trump, that he didn't want to have anything to do with Ukrainians of any stripe, influenced wrongly by the nonsense Giuliani had been feeding him, I didn't play along. Danilyuk obviously wanted a closer relationship with us, which I strongly supported and which was much easier to talk about. Danilyuk was surprised and uncomfortable that I didn't readily agree to a Zelensky visit, which came from the incessant boosterism of the others in the meeting, but I wasn't about to explain to foreigners that the three of them were driving outside their lanes. The more I resisted, the more Sondland pushed, getting into Giuliani territory I saw as out of bounds. In the later congressional hearings, Fiona Hill accurately testified that after the meeting and a picture with Danilyuk and the hordes of U.S. officials at the meeting, I told her to get into a meeting Sondland held on his own in the wardroom with the Ukrainians and others from the meeting in my office. I was stunned at the simple-mindedness of pressing for a face-to-face Trump-Zelensky meeting where the Giuliani issues could be resolved, an approach it appeared Mulvaney shared from his frequent meetings with Sondland. I told her to take this whole matter to the White House counsel's office. She quoted me accurately as saying, I am not part of whatever drug deal Sondland and Mulvaney are cooking up. I thought the whole affair was bad policy, questionable legally, and unacceptable as presidential behavior. Was it a factor in my later resignation? Yes, but as one of many straws that contributed to my departure. Earlier, Hill testified, I had called Giuliani a hand grenade who's going to blow everybody up, which still sounds right today. Perry and Sondland in particular kept pushing, including on Danilyuk to press me at least for a Trump-Zelensky phone call before the Rada elections. I continued to fend them off, fearing the call could backfire. I was off to Japan and South Korea on Saturday morning, July 20th, the day before the parliamentary elections, to discuss the base cost issues. I called Kupperman from the air, now that it was clear any Trump call would be after the Rada elections, asking him to call Danilyuk and politely tell him to stop listening to Sondland. Kupperman told me shortly thereafter that Danilyuk was very grateful to receive this news, as was Bill Taylor, our chargé in Kiev, who knew just as we did Sondland was freelancing. Most interesting, Danilyuk said the Trump-Zelensky meeting, or call, was not his idea, but Sondland's. The whole thing was a complete goat rope. Zelensky's supporters did very well in the elections, receiving about 43% of the vote, enough to give his party and like-minded independent candidates a working majority in the Rada. I hoped this was an important step toward moving things back into proper channels. I returned from Asia the evening before Trump's now famous July 25th call to Zelensky. I briefed him quickly ahead of the call at 9 a.m., which I expected to be a repeat of the essentially pro forma congratulatory call Trump made on the evening of Zelensky's own victory in the presidential runoff. I explained that Ukraine had just seized a Russian tanker and crew in retaliation for the Russian seizures that touched off the Kerch Strait incident in 2018, which showed real spine on the part of Zelensky and his new team. Sondland, whom I had kept off my briefing call, which would have been the first time in my tenure that any ambassador would have participated in such a briefing, had, through Mulvaney, spoken with Trump at 7:30 a.m. on God knows what agenda. The call record of the Trump-Zelensky discussion, which I listened to, as is customary, compiled by NSC note-takers now released publicly, is not a transcript like that produced by a court reporter of testimony in trial or in depositions. Soon after arriving at the White House on May 18, 2018, I met with Eisenberg to discuss the process for creating these call records and how it had evolved. We decided to leave things as they were to avoid recording as final, under the Presidential Records Act, things that shouldn't be kept for posterity. Until the Ukraine controversy broke, I was not aware we ever deviated from that policy, including storage procedures. Nor, at the time, did I think Trump's comments in the call reflected any major change in direction. The linkage of the military assistance with the Giuliani fantasies was already baked in. The call was not the keystone for me, but simply another brick in the wall. These are my recollections of what was important in the conversation, not from the call record. Trump congratulated Zelensky on the Rada elections, and Zelensky thanked Trump, adding, "I should run more often so we can talk more often. We are trying to drain the swamp in Ukraine. We brought in new people, not the old politicians." Trump said, "We do a lot for Ukraine, much more than the European countries, who should do more, like Germany. They just talk. When I talk to Angela Merkel, she talks about Ukraine but doesn't do anything. The U.S. has been very, very good to Ukraine, but it's not reciprocal because of things that have happened." Giuliani's conspiracy theories. Zelensky answered, "You are absolutely right, 1,000%. I did talk and meet with Merkel and Macron, and they're not doing as much as they should do. They are not enforcing sanctions against Russia. The EU should be our biggest partner, but the U.S. is, and I'm very grateful to you for that. The U.S. is doing much more on sanctions." He then thanked the U.S. for its defense assistance, saying he wanted to buy more javelins. Trump turned to the real issue. "I would like you to do us a favor because our country has been through a lot and Ukraine knows a lot about it. Find out about CrowdStrike, a cyber company the DNC used. The server. People say Ukraine has it. I would like our attorney general to call you and get to the bottom of it. The whole thing ended yesterday with Mueller, his televised House hearing. Impotent. Incompetent. I hope you can get to the bottom of it." Zelensky answered, This is very important for me as president, and we are ready for future cooperation and to open a new page in our relations. I just recalled the Ukrainian ambassador to the United States, and he will be replaced to make sure our two countries are getting closer. I want a personal relationship with you. I will tell you personally, one of my assistants just spoke to Giuliani. He will travel to Ukraine and we will meet. I will surround myself with the best people. We will continue our strategic partnership. The investigation will be done openly and candidly. I promise, as the president of Ukraine. Trump said, "You had a good prosecutor. Mr. Giuliani is a highly respected man. If he could call you along with the attorney general, and if you could speak to him, it would be great." The former ambassador from the United States was bad news. The people she was dealing with were bad news. There is lots of talk about Biden's son stopping the prosecution against those formulating and executing the Russia collusion operation. He went around bragging that he stopped the prosecution. It sounds horrible. Zelensky said, "Since we have an absolute majority in parliament, the next prosecutor general will be 100% my candidate. He will start in September. He will look at the company. The investigation is to restore honesty. If you have any additional information to provide us, please do so. With regard to the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Yovanovitch, I'm glad you told me she was bad. I agree 100%. Her attitude toward me was far from the best. She would not accept me as president." Trump responded, "I will tell Giuliani and Attorney General Barr. I'm sure you will figure it out. Good luck with everything. Ukraine is a great country. I have many Ukrainian friends." Zelensky said he had lots of Ukrainian-American friends too, and added, "Thank you for your invitation to Washington. I'm very serious about the case. There is a lot of potential for our two countries. We want energy independence." Trump said, "Feel free to call. We'll work out a date." Zelensky then invited Trump to Ukraine, noting both would be in Warsaw on September 1st for the 80th anniversary of Germany's invasion of Poland, launching World War II, suggesting Trump could then come to Kiev, which Trump politely discouraged. These were, to me, the key remarks in the July 25th call that later raised so much attention, deservedly so, whether impeachable, criminal, or otherwise. When, in 1992, Bush 41 supporters suggested he ask foreign governments to help out in his failing campaign against Bill Clinton, Bush and Jim Baker completely rejected the idea. Trump did the precise opposite. The next week, the State and Defense Departments pressed to transfer nearly $400 million of security assistance to Ukraine, calling for high-level meetings as bureaucracies do reflexively. Of course, the bureaucrats didn't know that Pompeo, Esper, and I had been discussing this subject quietly for some time, making efforts with Trump to free up the money, all of which had failed. By the time I resigned, we calculated that, individually and in various combinations, we had talked to Trump between 8 and 10 times to get the money released. If the bureaucrats believed that a principals committee would change Trump's mind, they hadn't been paying much attention for 2.5 years. I told Tim Morrison, Fiona Hill's successor, to have the State and Defense Departments stop focusing on meetings, but I wanted to have the funds ready in case Trump did agree to release them. For that to happen, we needed to prepare the necessary paperwork to be sure we could obligate the security assistance before the fiscal year's looming September 30th end. Under long-standing budget rules applicable to the legislation earmarking these funds, they would disappear if not obligated by that point. That's why the bureaucracy was beginning to show signs of agitation. Of course, one might ask why the bureaucracy didn't start agitating earlier in the fiscal year rather than waiting until the end and blaming their potential troubles on someone else. One might ask, but that's the way bureaucracies operate, painfully slowly, and then blaming others when things go wrong. On August 1st, I spoke with Barr to brief him on what Trump said to Zelensky about Giuliani and Trump's references to Barr himself. I suggested we have someone rein Giuliani in before he got completely out of control. We also discussed the status of Halkbank and the still-pending question of sanctioning Turkey for purchasing Russian S-400 air defense systems. Barr said he was waiting to hear back from Halkbank's counsel on the Justice Department's latest settlement offer. On October 15th, just after I left the administration, the Justice Department returned a blistering indictment against Halkbank in New York, having obviously found the final settlement offer by the bank's attorneys inadequate. Esper, Pompeo, and I continued exchanging thoughts about how to persuade Trump to release the security assistance before September 30th. We could have confronted Trump directly, trying to refute the Giuliani theories and arguing that it was impermissible to leverage U.S. government authorities for personal political gain. We could have, and we almost certainly would have failed, and perhaps have also created one or more vacancies among Trump's senior advisors. The correct course was to separate the Ukraine security assistance from the Ukraine fantasies, get the military aid approved, and deal with Giuliani and the fantasies later. I thought, in fact, I had already initiated the second Giuliani-related track with the White House Counsel's Office and subsequently with Bill Barr. There was also no point in encouraging more fruitless grinding at lower levels of the bureaucracy. None of that would have any impact on Trump's decision-making and could only risk press stories that would dig Trump in even more deeply against releasing the aid. That, at least, was my assessment at the time, and one that I believe Esper and Pompeo agreed with. We fully appreciated the implications of the approaching deadline, but we also knew our maneuvering room was limited. With the usually unstated problem of the 2016 and 2020 election conspiracy theories at the root. We all knew just what Trump's thinking was, which was why we believed it was critical to move the issue for his decision only at the right moment. Timing the approach incorrectly could doom the assistance once and for all. Thus, when Trump raised the issue of Ukraine during the discussion of Afghanistan at Bedminster on Friday, August 16th, asking how much we were spending there, I was worried that, in the heat of the contentious Afghan discussion, the Ukraine aid could be lost for good. Esper surprised me with his response, saying that Acting Office of Management and Budget Director Russ Vogt had stopped that, meaning stopped attempts to keep the aid from being released. This implied the decision was made and further discussion foreclosed, which I definitely did not believe. Fortunately, Ukraine passed into and out of Trump's free-flowing monologue without further incident. The Office of Management and Budget had, of course, by then entered the picture, ostensibly for budgetary reasons, but we suspected more likely because Trump used Mulvaney to put a stop to any efforts by the State or Defense Departments to move funds they respectively supervised. The Budget Office was also trying to rescind more than $4 billion of foreign economic assistance, which affected only the State Department, not the Pentagon, an annual exercise. As in 2018, the budgeteers ultimately backed down, mostly because there would have been open warfare with Congress had Trump decided to proceed with rescission. Mulvaney and others later argued that the dispute over Ukraine's security assistance was related to rescinding the economic assistance, but this was entirely an ex post facto rationalization. With time drawing short, I suggested to Pompeo and Esper that I again see how Trump was leaning, and the three of us then coordinate our schedules to talk to Trump together, with which they agreed. The next morning, August 20th, I took Trump's temperature on the Ukraine security assistance, and he said he wasn't in favor of sending them anything until all the Russia investigation materials related to Clinton and Biden had been turned over. That could take years, so it didn't sound like there was much of a prospect that the military aid would proceed. Nonetheless, with time running out, I said that Esper, Pompeo, and I would like to see Trump about the issue later in the week, which he accepted. Because of scheduling difficulties for Pompeo and Esper, and because I left Friday morning for the Biarritz G7 summit, Kupperman sat in for me on August 23rd to discuss Ukraine. Unfortunately, it was during a meeting where Trump once again decided to do nothing after an Iranian Houthi downing of yet another U.S. drone, the third in recent months. The discussion on Ukrainian aid was brief. Trump punted, saying, "Let me think about it for a couple of days. I will talk to the others at the G7 about it." Esper, about to attend a NATO defense ministerial meeting, said he would press other members to do more on Ukraine, which could also help. It could have been worse, but time was slipping away. At the G7, it seemed France and Germany were more optimistic that Putin might take steps to decrease tensions with Ukraine, such as an exchange of hostages and the ship crews detained in November. Because Biarritz was so fraught with dangerous near misses on Iran, however, Ukraine played a relatively minor role, although most other G7 members strongly opposed inviting Russia to the U.S.-hosted G7 in 2020. After Biarritz, having come close to resigning, I flew to Kiev to meet Zelensky personally, as well as key members of his incoming team. I hoped to ensure that the upcoming Zelensky-Trump meeting in Warsaw, which could not be avoided, would be a success. Flying to Kiev on August 26th, I spoke with Volker about Ukrainian Independence Day 2 days before, which he thought Zelensky had handled well. Volker stressed that Zelensky had no wish to become involved in U.S. domestic politics, although he was happy to have investigated whatever may have happened in 2016 before his time. In Kiev, I met again with Danilyuk, accompanied by Chargé Bill Taylor and several NSC officials, for an extended discussion on how a Ukrainian National Security Council might function, as well as dealing with the Russians in Crimea and the Donbas. Taylor and I then laid a wreath at a memorial for the approximately 13,000 Ukrainians killed in the ongoing war with Russia. The next day, we had breakfast with Ivan Bakanov, then the acting chairman of the Ukrainian Security Service, confirmed a few days later to delete the "acting" from his title. Bakanov was responsible for reforming the security services, a formidable task, but our embassy officials believed he was the right person for the job. Much of our conversation, as with Danilyuk the day before, was about Motorsich and Antonov, two key aerospace companies that were in danger of slipping under Chinese or other foreign control, which would make it almost impossible for the U.S. to cooperate with them. These firms, and many others, were the legacy of Soviet days, put there by those expert communist economic planners for no particular reason, but left an independent Ukraine with significant assets it didn't want to see slip away. Now here was a strategic interest that should have been a high priority for U.S. decision makers. Next was a meeting with Minister of Defense designate Andriy Zakharodnik, who was determined to make significant reforms in Ukraine's military in the midst of ongoing armed conflict with Russia and its surrogate forces in the Donbas. He favored using the pending U.S. security aid not just to buy weapons from U.S. firms, though he certainly wanted to do that, but also to obtain U.S. help in building the Ukraine military's institutional capabilities. By so doing, he expected to multiply the effects of the assistance into the future. At the end of the day, I also met with General Ruslan Khomchak, chief of the Ukraine General Staff, with whom I discussed the Donbas and Crimea at length. Khomchak was also an enthusiastic supporter of U.S. military assistance. He stressed the need to change the culture of Ukraine's military, including through providing English language training and other reforms to break free from Moscow's influence. He was also very worried about Russian efforts to build up military strength in the region, which would be a direct threat to both Poland and Ukraine. These were serious matters that I found both Zakharodnik and Khomchak taking seriously. We then rode to the Presidential Administration Building for a meeting with Zelensky's Chief of Staff, Andriy Bodin, and one of his deputies, Ruslan Ryabashapka. Bodin had been Zelensky's lawyer in private life, and also represented the oligarch Igor Kolomoisky. There was visible tension between Bodin and Danilyuk, who joined us a bit later, foreshadowing Danilyuk's mid-September resignation as National Security Advisor to Zelensky. Danilyuk's arrival also brought Ivan Bakanov, Vadim Pristaiko, the foreign minister designate, and Ivaris Abramavichus, the head of the state-owned holding company that effectively controlled Ukraine's defense industrial base, including Motosich and Antonov, into the meeting. Bodin stressed that Ukraine was counting on U.S. support for the reform program. Although Zelensky had an absolute majority in the Rada, most of the new parliamentarians, along with Zelensky's own inner circle, had no government experience at all. The cabinet, accordingly, had been selected on the basis of technical expertise and included people from a number of the other political parties and some career officials like Pristaiko, who was then serving as Ukraine's ambassador to NATO, pressing its case for admission. We talked about a wide range of issues, following which I had 45 minutes alone with Pristaiko to talk foreign policy. Interestingly, Ukraine, along almost unimaginably with state's legal advisor's office, had concluded that our withdrawal from the INF treaty meant that the entire treaty had expired. Accordingly, as a successor state to the USSR and previously therefore theoretically bound by the treaty, Ukraine was now free to develop its own INF non-compliant missile systems. Given the situation with the Crimea annexed and the Donbas in jeopardy, this was no small matter for Ukraine, Europe, or the United States. Whatever the Western Europeans thought, Ukraine and other Eastern European states had their own ideas about how to respond to Russia's intermediate-range missile capabilities. As the larger meeting ended, before meeting with Pristaiko, I pulled Ryabashapka aside to speak with him one-on-one. He had not said much during the meeting, which I hoped showed his discretion. Ryabashapka, as the soon-to-be equivalent to the U.S. Attorney General, was the Zelensky cabinet official most likely required to deal with Giuliani's conspiracy theories, and also the Ukrainian official Bill Barr would turn to for any legitimate government-to-government legal issues. Here, I had my only conversation in Ukraine on Giuliani's issues, and a very brief one at that. I urged Ryabashapka to speak directly to Barr and the Justice Department as soon as he took office, figuring this was the best way to prevent fantasy from overwhelming reality. I didn't mention the words Rudy Giuliani, hoping the omission spoke volumes. Time would tell. The Zelensky meeting began at 12:30 p.m. and lasted until about 2. On the Ukrainian side were basically all those who had participated in the earlier meetings. Bill Taylor, NSC officials, and several embassy officers comprised the U.S. side. Zelensky was impressive throughout, very much in command of the issues. He started by thanking us for keeping our Crimea sanctions in place and our continued non-recognition of Russia's purported annexation. I thought, if only he knew how close we were to giving all that away. We discussed Crimea, the Donbas, the failing Normandy format peace process, and his desire to get the U.S. and the U.K. more active in resolving the Russia-Ukraine dispute. Domestically, Zelensky said the fight against corruption, the centerpiece of his presidential campaign, was his highest priority. His Servant of the People Party, named after his TV show, had 254 Rada members, and he said that when the new session opened, they would introduce 254 reform bills, one for each party member to shepherd through. Zelensky emphasized that the time for promises alone was over, and it was now time to implement the promises he had campaigned on. He said the issue that prompted his first call to Putin was trying to get the Ukrainian sailors released. He was determined to get the Donbas back as soon as possible and end the war within the Minsk agreements. Zelensky had very specific ideas for a ceasefire, starting at one particular town and then expanding it. There would be no diplomatic games from him, he said, but Ukraine needed to see reciprocal steps from Russia. He wanted to resolve the issue, not let it drag out for years. We also discussed the tricky issue of what would happen if the Donbas were resolved, but not Crimea. No one, including the U.S., had a way around this dilemma, but Zelensky stressed that the West as a whole had to keep sanctions tied to the Crimea problem, not just ending the Donbas war. After discussing Belarus and Moldova and their common problems with Russia and corruption, we concluded. There was no discussion of Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, or anything in Giuliani land. If this didn't demonstrate what America's real interests were and what Zelensky should raise with Trump in Warsaw, I didn't know how else to do it. I left Kiev confident Zelensky understood the magnitude of the task facing him, at home and abroad, as did his incoming team. These were people we could work with, so long as we didn't get lost in the fever swamps, which remained to be seen. Taylor, who had been in all my meetings except my brief Ryabashapka one-on-one, spoke to me alone before I left for the airport, asking what he should do about the swirling Giuliani issues. I sympathized with his plight, so I urged him to write a first-person cable to Pompeo, telling him what he knew. First-person cables are rare, direct messages from a chief of mission straight to the Secretary of State, reserved for extraordinary circumstances, which we obviously had here. Besides, it was past time to get Pompeo more actively into the fray. Taylor's subsequent congressional testimony made him one of the most important witnesses in the House impeachment investigation. On August 29th, I flew from Kiev to Moldova and Belarus, continuing my travels in the former republics of the USSR. I wanted to show Russia we had a sustained focus on its periphery and were not content simply to leave these struggling states to contend with Moscow alone. Had I stayed in the White House longer, I had more substantive plans for U.S. relations with the former Soviet states. But that was not to be. Particularly in Minsk, despite Alexander Lukashenko's less-than-stellar human rights record, I wanted to prove the U.S. would not simply watch Belarus be reabsorbed by Russia, which Putin seemed to be seriously considering. One aspect of my strategy was a meeting the Poles arranged in Warsaw on Saturday, August 31st, among the national security advisors of Poland, Belarus, Ukraine, and the United States. Let the Kremlin think about that one for a while. I obviously had much more in mind than just having additional meetings, but this was one that would signal other former Soviet republics that neither we nor they had to be passive when faced with Russian belligerence or threats to their internal governance. There was plenty we could all do diplomatically as well as militarily. After I resigned, the administration and others seemed to be moving in a similar direction. Flying from Minsk to Warsaw, I called Pompeo to brief him on the trip to Ukraine, Moldova, and Belarus. I relayed specifically what Taylor had told me candidly in Kiev. He had left the private sector to rejoin the government temporarily as chargé in a country where he had been ambassador, a rare occurrence if it ever happened before, because of how strongly he supported a close Ukraine-U.S. relationship. If we took an indifferent or hostile approach toward Ukraine, he said, I'm not your guy here, which Pompeo confirmed Taylor had also said explicitly before taking on the post in the spring, after Yovanovitch was removed. Neither Pompeo nor I had any doubt that Taylor's resignation was nearly certain if the military assistance did not go through. I asked whether it might be possible to get a decision on the security funds before Trump left for Warsaw. Pompeo thought it was, noting also that he would have another chance on Air Force One, which was leaving Andrews Friday night and arriving in Warsaw Saturday morning. The meeting with Zelensky was scheduled for Sunday morning, so there was also at least some time in Warsaw. Jim Inhofe, chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, was trying to reach me, and Pompeo and I reviewed the several Hill options we had been considering and discussing quietly to get some relief from the September 30th deadline. There might be ways to buy more time, usually impossible at a fiscal year's end, but doable here in a variety of ways because of the overwhelming bipartisan support for security assistance to Ukraine. That night, we learned Trump would not travel to Poland because of Hurricane Dorian's approach to Florida and that Pence would come instead, not landing until Sunday morning. Both Pompeo and Esper dropped off the trip, and the Warsaw schedule was thrown into disarray because Pence would arrive 24 hours later than planned for Trump. In particular, the Zelensky meeting would now have to be after the ceremony for the 80th anniversary of the Nazi attack on Poland rather than before. All of that could be done, but it obviously meant that a Trump decision on Ukraine military aid had again been pushed to the back burner. Time was now racing away from us. On Friday evening Warsaw time, August 30th, I participated from Warsaw via video conference in an NSC meeting on Afghanistan with Trump and most others in the sitroom. As I have described, so consuming was the Afghanistan discussion that Trump was leaving the room before I realized the meeting was breaking up. I all but yelled at the screen, "Wait, what about Ukraine?" And everyone sat back down. Trump said, "I don't give a shit about NATO. I am ready to say, if you don't pay, we won't defend them. I want the $300 million, he meant $250 million, one piece of the assistance earmarked for Ukraine, to be paid through NATO." Of course, none of that was physically possible, reflecting Trump's continued lack of understanding of what these funds were and how they came to be earmarked, but there was nothing new there. "Ukraine is a wall between us and Russia," he said, meaning, I think, a barrier to closer Moscow-Washington relations. He then said to Pence, "Call NATO Secretary General Stoltenberg and have him have NATO pay. Say, the president is for you, but the money should come from NATO," which still didn't make any sense. "Wait until the NATO meeting in December," Trump said, implying, at least in my mind, that he was going to announce we were withdrawing. This was not good news, although Kupperman told me Senator Inhofe spoke with Trump for nearly 30 minutes after the NSC meeting, working on the security assistance question. Trump finally said to him, "Pence will soften my message," whatever that meant. Senator Ron Johnson told me a few days later he had also spoken to Trump and made the political point that support for Ukraine in Congress was nearly unanimous. He was not sure he had moved Trump, but I knew the number of House and Senate members preparing to call or meet with Trump was growing rapidly. Raw politics might yet do better with Trump than substantive arguments. In any case, the meeting ended inconclusively. Pence called Saturday night while flying to Warsaw to discuss Trump. I thought I heard him say that he knew it was the end of the fiscal year and there had been no prior notification to Ukraine we would want to cut the money off, but he had real concerns. "I think I know the president well enough that he might be saying, let's do this, but get our allies to do more in the future." I hoped that was the message he would deliver in Warsaw. Neither of us, however, yet knew. Pence landed in Warsaw on Sunday morning, slightly ahead of schedule, just before 10 a.m. To my surprise, Sondland had flown on Air Force 2 and also managed to crash the briefing the VP's staff had arranged, notwithstanding the advance team's efforts to keep him out. Sondland later testified that he had been invited at the very last minute. He invited himself over near physical efforts by the VP's advance people to keep him out. At the briefing, I told Pence in abbreviated form about my trip to the three Eastern European countries, especially my meeting with Zelensky and the other Ukrainians in Kiev. Subsequently, Sondland testified he had said in this same meeting that aid to Ukraine was being tied to the investigations Trump and Giuliani wanted, and that his comment had been duly noted by Pence. I don't recall Sondland saying anything at that meeting. Time was tight before we had to leave for Pilsudski Square, the venue for the ceremony, and where Pope John Paul II had given the famous 1979 Mass that many Poles believe marked the beginning of the end of the Cold War. We didn't return to the hotel until 2:30, well behind schedule because of the complex logistics for all the national leaders attending. In another opportunity to brief Pence, without Sondland's being present, I explained I had to leave the Zelensky meeting, which began at 3:30, almost an hour late, no later than 3:45. Pence and I concentrated on the security assistance issue and he acknowledged we still didn't have a good answer to give. Once Zelensky arrived, the press mob stumbled in, asking questions on the subject, which Pence ducked as adroitly as possible. The press left, as did I simultaneously, so my plane didn't lose its takeoff slot at Warsaw's crowded airport. I didn't hear until later, therefore, when Morrison called, that Zelensky had homed in on the security package as soon as the press departed. Pence danced around it, but the lack of a "yes, it's definitely coming" statement was impossible to hide. Fortunately, Sondland did not raise the Giuliani issues during the meeting with Zelensky, as he had pressed us to do. Afterward, however, said Morrison, Sondland had grabbed one of Zelensky's advisors, Andriy Yermak, who handled U.S. affairs and who had previously met with Giuliani. Morrison was not fully aware of what Sondland and Yermak had discussed, but I doubted it had to do with Crimea or the Donbass, let alone the implications of the demise of the INF treaty. Morrison told me in a subsequent conversation that Sondland had raised the Giuliani issues with Yermak. After a quiet Labor Day, I spent Tuesday at the White House catching up. When Haspel and the intelligence briefing team arrived before seeing Trump, she said, "You can't do that again." "What?" I asked. "Go away for a week," she said, and we all laughed. On September 4th, I spoke to Pence, still in Europe at Trump's Dunbeg, Ireland golf resort, which had become the latest scandal of the day. Pence was impressed with Zelensky and so informed Trump, concluding, "My recommendation and the consensus recommendation of your advisors is that we move forward with the $250 million. Pence also pressed Trump to meet Zelensky at the UN General Assembly and said that, just between us girls, he thought Trump was looking for a news peg to make what we hoped was the right decision. Zelensky didn't quite close the argument in their meeting, so I closed it for him, said Pence, which sounded positive. In the meantime, the press was beginning to sniff out the connection between withholding military assistance for Ukraine and Trump's obsession with the 2016 and 2020 elections in the persons of Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden. Bipartisan Hill opposition to withholding the aid continued to rise, which, all else failing, I hoped would produce the right result. It was not until the end of September, however, that the media began to appreciate what had been happening since well before the July 25th call. Over the weekend, Zelensky's prisoner swap with Russia proceeded, a positive event in its own right, and which Trump had seemingly indicated might be enough to get him to release the security assistance. Pompeo and I discussed this on the morning of September 9th, and Esper and I spoke about it by phone later that day, in both cases, continuing to press for legislative relief to buy more time. On Wednesday afternoon, Trump decided to release the Ukraine money. By then, I was a private citizen. At about 2:15 p.m. on Monday, September 9th, Trump called me down to the Oval where we met alone. He complained about press coverage on Afghanistan and the cancellation of the Camp David meeting with the Taliban, not to mention the overwhelmingly negative reaction, certainly among Republicans, both to the deal and the invitation of Taliban to Camp David. Of course, most of the negative reaction he had brought on himself by his ill-advised tweets. Perhaps surprisingly, nothing had leaked before the tweets, but they blew the lid off the story. He was furious he was being portrayed as a fool, not that he put it that way. He said, "A lot of people don't like you. They say you're a leaker and not a team player." I wasn't about to let that go. I said I'd been subject to a campaign of negative leaks against me over the past several months, which I would be happy to describe in detail, and I'd also be happy to tell him who I thought the leaks were coming from. Mostly, I believed the leaks were being directed by Pompeo and Mulvaney. As for the claim I was a leaker, I urged him to look for all the favorable stories about me in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and elsewhere, which often revealed who was doing the leaking, and he would find none. Trump asked specifically about the meeting with the Taliban, and I reminded him I had said merely the Taliban should go through a powerful magnetometer. What I had said was that I wouldn't have signed the State Department's deal, and Trump pointed his finger at me and said, "I agree." Then he was off again, saying, "You have your own airplane," which I explained briefly I did not. I flew on military aircraft on all official trips, following precisely the same policy that governed my predecessors and many other senior officials involved in national security. I didn't write these rules. I followed them. I knew this specifically was a Mulvaney complaint, the source of a lot of this nonsense. "You've got all your own people back there on the National Security Council staff," said Trump, another Mulvaney complaint. Of course, Trump's usual complaint was that the NSC staff included too many members of the deep state. At that point, I rose from the chair in front of the Resolute desk, saying, "If you want me to leave, I'll leave." Trump said, "Let's talk about it in the morning." That was my last conversation with Trump. I left the Oval at about 2:30 and returned to my office. I told Kupperman and Tinsley about the conversation and said that was it, as far as I was concerned. I gave my short resignation letter, written several months before, to Christine Similian, my assistant, to put on White House letterhead. I said I was going home to sleep on it overnight, but I was ready to resign the next day. In light of the subsequent controversy, I should note that on Tuesday, Kupperman told me that Dan Walsh, one of Mulvaney's deputies, had called him late Monday, returning with Trump on Air Force One from a North Carolina political rally Trump had departed for right after speaking with me. Trump was still spun up about my use of military aircraft, which Walsh had tried to explain to him unsuccessfully, and said to Walsh, "You tell him he's not getting another plane unless I specifically approve it." This comment from Trump demonstrates that late on Monday he still thought I'd be around making requests for military planes after seeing him on Tuesday. On Tuesday, September 10th, in the morning, I came in at my regular early hour, fulfilled a few remaining obligations, and then left to be at home when the firestorm hit. I asked Christine to take the letter down to the outer oval and deliver copies to Pence, Mulvaney, Cipollone, and Grisham at 11:30 a.m. I am confident Trump did not expect it, tweeting at about 11:50 to get his story out first. I should have struck preemptively, there's a lesson in that, but I was content to counter-tweet with the facts. I know how it actually ended. And with that, I was a free man again.